handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
A very good Tuesday, race fans. Sirius 162, XM 207, Sports Zone 999, and at SteveBick.com as well. Absolutely spectacular morning here. A little bit of a hectic morning because I'm traveling later, but don't know if this is, what do they call it? Is this false spring? At the very least, feels like maybe. Tina and I actually we were expressing the kind of surprise a little bit. We have not had much of a winter here, and at least with snow. So we're expecting one more snow, but I'll be gone. So. I won't have to worry about it. I did have to clear the driveway once while she was in Rochester. So it's been, as it happens, the snow throwing duties have been spread out. They're even. 1-1 this winter, but Tina's on her own now until April. Looking forward to getting down to Florida, down to Gulfstream for Fountain of Youth, and boy, this is a fun card. Got a little bit more into it yesterday, and actually even this morning a little bit. Although I was also tied into absorbing the release of Heise's Saratoga review study. And Alan Foreman is going to join us in about 10 minutes. We'll talk to Alan and let him walk through this. There's nobody more experienced when it comes to the sort of the cumulative study and assessments that come out of injury fatality clusters. And I mean, I don't need to go. I mean, we're going to go through it together anyway. But there was nothing that seems to have been revelatory in this study, and no one should have really expected anything, any landmark type conclusions, because it's always multifactorial, and there's no exact two incidents that are identical, and trying to tie a group of incidents together, you could look for commonalities and overall, potential risk factors. And that's being done and has been done now about, four times probably. I mean, the ones that we think of, and really the one that provided a blueprint was the aqueduct winter incident that, in fact, Alan was instrumental in studying, the task force. And some of this we discussed actually just last week with Jim Gagliano. There's been about four or five of these every so often, and there'll continue to be. And it's not there's not any one thing that everybody goes looking for, a smoking gun in these circumstances, and there isn't one. There's not going to be one. You know, there sometimes, yeah, sometimes there'll be a soft spot in the base, and there'll be a little bit of a sinkhole. Those get discovered. That does happen, but not when you've got, you know, not when you've got this cluster spread out on different places on the racetrack, on all the different courses. There's not, you're not. You know, there's going to be spikes. There's going to be clusters, and you know, everybody, you know, just can double down on the precautions. But there's some things in here that and some suggestions that are seem really irresponsible. I'll let Alan and certainly we'll let some horsemen discuss it. But you know, the suggestion that horses that are being exercised vigorously, what you got to be kidding. So now you're going to, now if there's an incident and if a horse goes wrong, you're going to say, oh, he worked him 5 furlongs there. Worked him. Oh, worked him in 59 and four. I mean, this is just, this is a fool's errand. And, you know, and seemingly, you know, this organization hell bent on trying to, you know, prove their worth. One of the things that is quite something, is them patting themselves on the back for drawing a conclusion on something that, you know, that everybody has known now for the last several years, as the use of clenbuterol is being dialed back and significantly. I it's this is it's very it's just It's a little exasperating. It didn't you didn't need 200 pages to tell you that there, you know, there was no one factor. It everybody that's worked on these, you know, knew the conclusion actually as it was happening. So, anyway, I'll let Alan work on it. And walk you through it. The I think Dr. Alday too later in the show, and we've actually got a couple of topics that I've been saving for Steve, including the dropping of charges and suspension and whatever against Jeff Engelhart after Haiwu traced back precisely what Jeff Engelhart had suggested, which was the horse, the whatever treatment was being suggested happened before the horse was in his care. And this actually gets right back to the conversation we had with Dr. Alday the last time he was on, which is when we discussed this. And I, you know, it does bring back the discussion about the inequity of, you know, these horses under scrutiny only when they get to the racetrack. Doesn't matter, you know, doesn't matter seemingly what, you know, how they're handled before that. And then, of course, people saying, well, Engelhart should have tested the horse. He should have done the hair testing. Unbelievable. And anything to blame horsemen and any pretzel logic that can be construed to picture and paint horsemen as, you know, addled morons. It's just amazing. Amazing. Anyway, I don't let me off in this tangent. So there's I'll try to keep the I'll try to keep the off the racetrack discussion you know, to a balanced element. We're going to talk. Looking forward, actually, to talking to Brian Cohen, Arundel, and of course, the win in the Razorback. And I thought it'd be fun, Octane, and We'll talk to Brian. A prominent operation for years in Florida. And we are, in fact, as I say that, there's the OBS March catalog. We'll be down there for the sale and 3 days before Vegas. But Brian Cohen's going to join us. How about that threatened visit with Whit Beckman? How many times have I said we're going to get to Whit? We're going to get to Whit. He'll join us after Brian, probably 10, 15, give or take. And yeah, then Horse Health Today, brought to you by Luberson and Reborn with Dr. Alday and Andy Serling. Andy's up visiting up here at Saratoga for a couple of days. He didn't invite me to lunch, actually, but I couldn't have gone anyway. And there's I'm waiting to hear on an 11:30 that I think could be valuable, and we'll see. Last night, I should mention, and part of the potential for the 11:30 that light up for racing, and they had their first gathering last night in Lexington, and looks to be based on the images and some of the things that came out during the evening. It looks like it was a success and well received and well attended, and have not had a chance to talk about this initiative, lightupracing.com. It's basically a lot of the things we've been talking about, which is and for years having a vehicle to answer general public and mainstream media misinformation and the kinds of things that that challenge us as an industry. So we'll see. The next, if you missed last night, the next gathering is March 5th, a week from, not even a week from, March 5th has got to be next Monday. Yeah, next Monday. I think, right? No, next Tuesday. Yeah, next Tuesday. I'm looking at still looking at the February calendar. This is one of my favorite things when I go on this trip. I leave, and when I come back, I've got to change all the calendars from, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 calendars hanging here, and there's 2 more sitting behind me that aren't hanging. You got to change all the calendars. Maybe I'll change the calendars. I think I say this every year before I go on this trip. Change the calendar from February all the way to April. March, they might as well, they want, save money on your calendar that you send me. You can leave March out because I'm never here. Well, that's a recent development, of course, because of the change in the NHC, moving the NHC into March. That has complicated. It's funny. It made life easier for Michelle Ravencraft and Holly and Keith and everybody at NTRA, because of course they used to have the Eclipse Awards right on top of then NHC right after. It was like this insane, like 3-4 week intensive that they were challenged to, everybody had to, jump through hoops. No sooner would the Eclipse Awards be over, they'd all hightail it to Vegas to set up for NHC. So this is giving them a breather. Yeah, it's the new relaxed Michelle and Holly and Keith and company. Coming up into about 15, so I guess we can actually reach for Alan and get the conversations going. I'm going to just rely on Alan, because I'm not somebody that wants to be that is negative really on too many topics, but this there's some frustrations here with this, with this scenario and with this report. But Alan, Alan's got the most unique perspective because he understands it, better than anybody. He created essentially the template for these studies. So there's nobody better. If you haven't seen, what's the best way? Pretty much any coverage of the release of this report yesterday has a link to the to the whole report. And there's an executive summary that starts it, and then there's tons of detail. And Alan Foreman joins us to discuss.
Good morning,
Alan. I pulled myself up before I made myself crazy regarding this report. I should just turn it over to you. You've been doing these. You created the template for studies of this ilk, and yet everyone gets released, and there's this bewildered, withering assessment that it's what everybody has said from the minute it happened. There's no one factor.
Well, Steve, typically there isn't going to be one factor. It's going to be a combination of factors, and I think that when you read the report, you have to read it in that context. When I first got involved in doing these kinds of reports over a decade ago, when Scott Palmer, Mary Scalay, Jerry Bailey, and I did the study of the 21 fatalities at Aqueduct, our mandate was to try to find the cause or causes, because it was anticipated that given the time frame, the number of fatalities, the differing conditions, there were so many things that had to be taken into account that it was unlikely that one cause was going to be the smoking gun of the report. There were a number of factors. And what I appreciate about this report, and what I appreciate about what HISAID is doing, is they're following the template that we created. If that is still a good template today, it was considered to be the gold standard then. It's the gold standard today, except that there are a lot more experts who are involved. There's a lot more data and information that can be gleaned. I mean, we were really starting from nowhere, and in this report, they brought in as many experts as they can. But the key takeaway from our report, and you can look at Santa Anita, you can look at Churchill, you can look at Maryland, and you can look at this one, is they talk about risk factors and they talk about contributing factors, because you're not going to find one smoking gun. We, with respect to the Saratoga meet, the New York Gaming Commission did its own analysis, and they said that while there are a number of contributing factors, what their primary concern was what they considered to be the increased moisture in the Saratoga main dirt track and the variation in the moisture content throughout the meet, because they had record rainfall. And so that is one factor. In the report that HISA issued yesterday, you said you can't overlook the weather conditions, but that was not a single factor. And so you then ask the question, well, you've got horses with musculoskeletal injuries. You have horses that have been injected within 30 days. You have a horse that was on the vets list. If you didn't have the moisture content in the ground, if you didn't have the weather conditions, would those fatalities have repeated themselves? Would they have occurred? And you don't know the answer to that question. You know, horsemen will say, well, you know, look, we run every day. We're running high-speed events. We're injecting our horses. We're doing a lot of things. And the horses aren't breaking down. But at Saratoga, they were breaking down in what we call – it was all in a cluster. Mm-hmm. And you look at – and I've said this to you before. You look at clusters, because that's the red flag, not that there's been a fatality here or a fatality there, but there have been a group of them. And so you can go one of two ways. You can say, man, this is just bad luck. So Churchill had bad luck. Maryland had bad luck. Saratoga had bad luck. Santa Anita had bad luck. Or you look at the factors that have been identified in the report and you put them together and say, yeah, there was a lot going on here that probably contributed to what happened, but we can't just say it's one thing. So, the report is comprehensive. It helps. It's part of a learning process. We're always learning here. How do we identify horses at risk, and what can we do to prevent fatalities. And it all goes into the database of information that we're trying to glean so that if circumstances repeat themselves in the future, you try to avoid these kinds of circumstances. And I'm quite sure that going forward, particularly with respect to moisture in the ground, weather, that they're going to look at other variables, be far more aggressive. And, you know, that then becomes an economic decision for, you know, between the track and the regulators as to, do you take a horse off the turf, put it on the dirt, do you cancel a race? You know, those all have economic consequences that, you know, we've learned over the years that creates a dynamic between the track operator and these safety protocols. And the safety protocols are going to have to win out every time now. There isn't going to be a margin of error.
Well, no. Why don't you walk through a little bit here and hit some of the highlights or the things that that stood out to you? And I've got a couple of questions, you know, along the way you know, racetrack surface starts it out, the location on the track where and the grass course where things happened. You know, some of the cropsy stuff, the rules, etc.
You can see the obvious things. Sue Stover, her expertise, I mean, she's world-renowned for her work with musculoskeletal injuries, you know, fetlock injuries. This is her wheelhouse. This is what she's going to focus on, the association between high-speed exercise and horses that are breaking down. And what can we learn in just looking at that information to try to prevent breakdowns going forward? So, for example, the focus on corticosteroid injections within 30 days, injections in the fetlock, is just, it's becoming a repetitive concern. And so HISA adopted a 30-day rule that has gone into effect. And the horsemen may, you know, some horsemen may not like it, but it's an important safety factor. And they will be studying to see whether backing out the corticosteroid injections in the fetlock beyond 30 days makes a difference. They're focusing on fatigue, high-speed workouts, high-speed races, because the incidence of fatalities in those races is obviously higher than in your distance races. The rule violations that are discussed here are more ministerial violations than they are substantive. And I don't think that the so-called rule violations had anything to do with these fatalities. The fact that a horse that was on the vets list somehow got to the starting gate is something that everybody just realizes was just a terrible oversight and should not have happened. And corrective action has been taken to see that doesn't happen again. But, you know, you come back again to this issue of weather, which is, look, I have always believed that one of the major contributing factors in the fatalities at Aqueduct was the unusual winter that we had back in 2011-2012. And there were numerous other contributing factors, but that one just stood out. But you can't prove it. Okay, so we had to speculate about it. And I believe that Scott, Mary, Jerry, and I all believe that. Santa Anita, there is no question in my mind. There were numerous contributing factors, but the unusual weather in California that winter was a massive contributing factor. The amount of moisture in the ground, the amount of rain. In Maryland, they talk about a lot of the contributing factors, but everybody in Maryland knew there was a problem with the racing surface. You know, we're disappointed that the report didn't come down harder on that fact. But there's no question about it. It was the racing surface, because once the racing surface was corrected, the fatalities never repeated themselves. Okay, so, you know, you can start to put those pieces of the puzzle together. Churchill was somewhat of an enigma, but it was an unusual winter. It was a track that had been dormant, you know, all winter, was reopening for the spring meet. You had horses that were coming in from other jurisdictions, may not have been used to the racing surface. They had bumped up purses with incentives. Those were all the kinds of things we looked at when we looked at the fatalities in Aqueduct. And they were all contributing factors, including the weather. And then you get to Saratoga, and to me, And I'm just talking Elza Lehman. I'm not the expert. I wasn't involved in these investigations. I'm not on any of the committees. But to me, the weather just sticks out and it begs the question, if the weather had been a normal summer, without the excessive rain, would these fatalities have occurred? And I, given the cluster of fatalities, the way and when they happened, that's my own view. I agree with everything they've said in the report. You're going to find that in any investigation. But I think the weather, to me, was the contributing factor that created kind of the perfect storm that happened here.
In regards to a seemingly new approach regarding a risk factor, what is your take on the exercise element of this, and now we're going to bring under scrutiny, and we're going to find a new thing to blame on trainers that they worked their horse too many furlongs between starts. That's the next target.
Well, I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's where it's going. What this industry is lacking is data. And an understanding of the phenomenon of, look, we know why horses break down. The question is, is there a process to intervene to prevent it from happening? Now, at some point, are we going to overreach once we start to put this information together? I don't know. But, we have a responsibility right now because we don't have a large margin of error with horses that are breaking down and public and media attention on it, if we're not demonstrating that we're doing everything that we can to identify horses at risk and try to prevent them from going to the starting gate. And that is a massive challenge, Steve. The work is in place, the work is being done, the data is being collected. I think, for example, from the Saratoga meet, just the work that Scott Palmer and the Racing Surfaces Committee and with a number of other experts, they're going to be able to better identify at what point you decide either to cancel a race or to move it. And that's not something we do right now with any kind of science behind it. It's basically just, anecdotal or eyeball or whatever. And then you have, what happened at Saratoga. But, it's not like we're whistling in the wind here. We're really trying to, this is an ongoing challenge of identifying contributing factors and horses at risk because we're just going to have to do it.
A Dr. Parkin kind of an analysis and some more details. But in trying to make sense of the of these case horse comparisons, every horse is an individual. I mean, they're trying to apply, and I'm going to let Dr. Alday riff on this. They're trying to apply a control group of horses that seemingly are similar to they were on a similar career arc as the horses that were injured or died, and I don't know how you can draw conclusions exactly. Maybe this will prove very useful, but it's just you got different outfits, you've got different pedigrees, you've got different confirmation, it seems, Alan, like this is a reach, and it's fine to go reach into some areas that we haven't explored before. I mean, that's how we've been able to lower, the incidence per thousand from 2 to 1.25 over 15 years. So, doing new things, no one's objecting, but maybe I'm just not enough of a statistical type to understand how you're going to draw conclusions here other than to suggest, as a new way to suggest that somebody did something inept.
Well, you know, this is something that I took out of the report. If you were, you know, a number of us have been obviously very exercised about the 60 Minutes piece that was done last fall, which clearly tried to draw a connection between the use of performance-enhancing drugs and horses breaking down on the racetrack. It was unmistakable in their report. If you read this report, nowhere do you see any association between the fatalities and the use of performance-enhancing drugs, illicit drugs, or improper medication. That's important because to the extent that the media or the public believes that horses are being drugged and that's why they're breaking down, you can point to these reports and say, we've done an extensive study. We've done necropsies. We've analyzed every one of these fatalities as if we were analyzing a plane crash. And that association isn't there. And that's important. I don't think the industry promotes that enough, number one. Number two, you know, you're looking in every one of these situations, you're looking to see if that fatality could have been prevented. Okay, that's when we did the study back in 2011, 2012, we did that meticulous analysis. If you look back at our report, we meticulously analyzed the racing history of each horse that died, the circumstances surrounding that horse's racing career, medication treatments, training cycles, everything, to try to conclude with each fatality what may or may not have been the cause of that horse dying. And then you look for similarities. They all help you to get to the same place. And if it means that there needs to be interventions that the industry should impose, then we need to seriously look at that. I can't underscore enough. I know we all think, look, we've been this is the industry. This is what happens. The frequency of horses dying on the racetrack is remote, but the public doesn't see it that way. And legislators don't see it that way. And so we have to have answers. We have to do better. And you learn from these situations. And I don't see the imposition of sweeping changes that are going to have to occur. But I think we have to seriously look at, because the incidents, you know, get these clusters. That's the problem. It's not a fatality here, a fatality there. You can look at those. It's that they happen in groups. And when they happen in groups, there has to be an explanation.
Well, and I mean, there's broad explanation and, you know, essentially, you know, all of the things that we've learned over the past, you know, 12 to 14 years, it is cumulative. And you wouldn't have had already the progress that's been made without it. And, you know, progress, you know, is made. You know, one point, Alan, and you and I discuss this all the time, and I brought it up with Jim Gagliano last week, which was we can tell our story, but we can't try to utilize statistics on a meat by meat basis. And you know, the numbers, we can't try to use that as a marketing gimmick. It's a dangerous, he had zero fatalities this meet. What are you going to say next meet when there's four?
No, I agree with that. I agree with you on that. I am not a fan of, we talk about that amongst ourselves. We at the Mid-Atlantic strategic plan meetings, we would talk about from meet to meet the changes, what's occurring, how's everyone doing. But here's something that I think, at least from a marketing standpoint, can be considered. Before the imposition of HISA, safety protocols were voluntary. When we did the Mid-Atlantic strategic plan, we brought all the jurisdictions in the Mid-Atlantic together, some in addition to that. And we came up with a plan to identify horses at risk, identify contributing factors. What are we learning? What protocols can we impose? We were all doing that voluntarily. And some jurisdictions were willing to make changes and others weren't. We now have a national safety program patterned after the reforms from the Mid-Atlantic, from California, from Kentucky. And I think that at some point we will see what the impact of a national uniform safety program has had. If the numbers don't change, if we don't feel that it's been a useful exercise and it's making for a better, safer environment for our horses, then I think we have to seriously look at, you know, what's going on. But, you know, I would like to think that with a mandated national safety program, you know, you're not going to eliminate the fatalities, and you're going to, when you get a situation where you've got clusters, we pounce on it, we try to figure out what's going on, and we try to make things better. But I'd like to think that we're in a better place than we were before Hives. And that's, you know, what one of the positives of this new program was that we would have a mandated national safety program.
Well, and, you know, to again, to their credit, as we say, they've tried to morph and react to, you know, to things that, you know, have been missteps. Certainly, you know, can admire that. There's a few things actually we can fold into this conversation after we finish with the with some of the data. You talked about the vet list aspect. Talk about the injections, and I know that Lisa Lazarus has been on a speaking tour that has specifically addressed this in front of horsemen, and it's something that actually the Mid-Atlantic brought up prominently before any other jurisdiction or any other organization. But the corticosteroid injections, Alan, where are we with this?
So look, historically, well, first of all, there was one corticosteroid that was used for years, dipamedrol, methylprednisolone acetate, that we learned, and it was actually through the Pennsylvania Horseman's Retirement Program, that that corticosteroid was destroying cartilage in the knee and was having a significant detrimental effect on the horses. And so we eliminated it. With respect to the other corticosteroids, you at one point you were at a 7-day administration time, but horses being claimed, horses being treated, horses were repetitively being treated with corticosteroids. And while corticosteroids are extremely important and useful tools in the treatment of injury in the horse, a lot of the experts said it wasn't necessary to repetitively inject these horses, and it might even be detrimental, and that if you administered a corticosteroid to a horse at 14 days, it would have the same effect as 7 days. So they backed everything out to 14 days. Okay. And they said, you've got, you know, when you treat a horse, you've got to allow the treatment to take effect. Just continuing to inject isn't going to make that big a difference, but it might be detrimental to the horse. Now, as you can see, with respect to concerns about fetlock injuries, the sense is that they've got to back out the treatment even further because the treatment may be masking, some abnormality with the horse or some problem that could affect the horse's performance, which is why they've moved it out to 30 days. There is, and I can't speak to the internal considerations of Hives on this. There is a Horseman's Advisory Committee. They've been involved in these discussions. They made their recommendations. But I can tell you that the use of corticosteroids, the administration times, are all being watched very carefully by the Hives Anti-Doping Committee. And they're the ones who make the decisions with respect to, based on expert advice as to as to the direction this is going.
Well, and that's one of the things about reading. Well, certainly the executive summary. There was just seemingly statements that essentially are things that have already been, you know, widely recognized and acted upon. The idea that, that this is, that there's new ground that was somehow covered is just,
No, I don't think it's at its new ground. I think it reinforces what they've been, you know, what they've been finding. So, and they say in the report, you know, we've changed the rule now to the injection. The fetlock is now at 30 days. It's too soon to determine what effect that's had. But they point to it and say that, look, we recognize with respect to the fatalities at Saratoga, there was a high incidence of fetlock injuries. And that is something that just is a red flag. And so they say, you know, we've changed the rule. We haven't, you know, had enough time to determine its impact. And there really hasn't been enough time. So it reinforces what they're saying, and that's what data does. Data does give you insight into what's going on.
Well, it is. It's a cumulative progress.
I don't think you can take anything for granted in this business, or you can say, well, you know, that's the way it's always been. I think that, and look, data is data, and people can debate what the impact or importance of the data is. You've got the veterinary community looking at this. You've got other researchers who are looking at this. There's so much we can learn, and you learn from every incident. And I think they've learned things from, I think, the industry and New York and NYRA, New York Gaming Commission, HISA, have all learned from this, from the incident at Saratoga last summer. And I, you know, look, I come back to the racing surface and I come back to the weather, and I think that they're going to have more data, more protocols to look at this factor and help them make decisions if we get into an unusual situation next year, or this year, I'm sorry, we're already into 2024.
True. You know, part of this too, you know, the fact that five of these 13 incidents were on the turf course, and that, you know, there's a randomness to horses, you know, having serious incidents on the turf. And you know, there was a summer a few years ago where we had like three within like a 3 or 4 day period, but as it happened, that was a summer which was inordinately dry, and you had a mm-hmm. very hard turf course. I mean, this turf mm-hmm. course, at no point was this turf course, you know, hard and
right.
dangerous in that regard.
And you look to the fatigue factor. You know, fatigue is an important word in this report. And, you know, if you're running in a very deep turf course, or if you're yeah. dirt course, the conditions have changed because massive rainfall. Horses that have pre-existing injuries that might not react on a normal surface and who get fatigued are likely to, you know, likely probably isn't a fair word, but, you know, may be at risk of suffering some kind of a catastrophic injury. Well, it just exacerbates the problem, you know. Try running on a wet beach if you've got an issue, you know. It exacerbates what may be a pre-existing injury. Now, look, I shouldn't be, you know, that's kind of simplifying things, but you can relate to it. You know, the horse is, you know, if he's suffering fatigue and he's got a pre-existing injury, he may be more prone to, you know, something catastrophic happening.
Well,
it's rare, but, you know, when you see these clusters, it's a cluster. People make fun of me. I keep using the word cluster, but it's a grouping of fatalities in a short period of time, and that's a very rare event in racing.
Yeah, and even, you know, the mapping of the 13 13 incidents is interesting, and to some degree on along those lines, because you had two that occurred on gallop outs, then of course you had the two just incredibly mm-hmm. tragic scenarios in deep stretch. So essentially four of the eight dirt incidents happened at a exertion limit, you know, scenario. Mm-hmm. I think even the one of the turf incidents was a gallop out as well. So you know, then the other ones on turns, you know, when horses are changing leads and are putting you know, are putting pressure on limbs, you know, at a high rate of speed. I mean, there's so much of this that, you know, we're just very, you know, we see over and over again. And it's a confluence, and I I see, Alan, is heaps of criticism of, you know, of every aspect, you know, this thing being released and the way it's, you know, the way it was received.
I can't say that. You know, I look at each of these incidents. You know, the aqueduct report was a wake up call. Okay, it really was. There were a lot of things that were going on that either the industry didn't pick up on it, or didn't realize what was happening, or just you know, didn't think it would happen. I don't think that anybody in the Saratoga meet, it's not as if they were asleep at the wheel. Yeah, there was one incident that really just was an embarrassment to everyone. On the horse that never should have gotten to the starting gate. We all know that. But, you know, the circumstances happen. I think these reports are incredibly valuable because they allow you to address public concerns, media concerns. You can start telling the story, but as an industry, we've got to learn what the risk factors are. We've got to be able to identify them. And yeah, we have to be a little bit more overcautious because our margin of error is so small. And so if we can learn from these reports, we can learn from these incidents and do better, that's all going to benefit us in the long run. You can't put your head in the sand.
No, that's true. No, no doubt.
And I'm not seeing any criticism here coming out of this report. They kind of tell it like it is, and, you know, people are going to have their same reaction. Oh, we knew it was the weather, and they didn't have the, you know, they wouldn't say it. And in the Maryland report, people were kind of shaking their heads, you know, oh, great, we get all this information. Everybody knows it was the racing surface. We know at Santa Anita, they had a horrendous winter weather there, and there were other factors combined with the weather that caused those injuries to continue to occur. And you look back at Aqueduct, and why did it take so long for people to wake up to the fact that there were horses breaking down at a regular rate? And so to the extent that we as an industry can see this when it happens and jump on it real time and have some ability to deal with it, we're better off.
Alan Foreman with us as we look at the report Saratoga this past summer. Alan, a couple of other related issues. The situation with Jeff Engelhardt and the clenbuterol charge being dropped because in fact, Haiwu came to understand his explanation, tracing back to application before he bought the horse. This opens up a whole nother avenue. What's your thought about what transpired here? Were you involved at all?
No, Jeff? I was not involved at all. The system as it is worked. Okay, people are going to say, well, he never should have been in that position in the first place. I personally don't like the fact that names and violations are published before, you know, there's further information that would not implicate a trainer in wrongdoing. So, you know, it's great that the public knows that he had a positive test, but, you know, he has to suffer that indignity until he's able to prove that it was not his fault or he had nothing to do with it or it should not have been a violation. And that's a constant complaint I get from horsemen. But the system did work, and the system puts the obligation on the horseman when he gets notice of a violation to establish that he was not at fault, that he had no significant fault or that the violation was a result of negligence. So when he learned about this violation, he did what he should have done. He asked for hair testing because with clenbuterol, and it was very prominent in the Service Navarro cases, was hair testing helped to identify the use of clenbuterol in those situations. And here it was his position that it could not have come from me, but I've got this horse at a sale. I know they give clenbuterol to these horses. I know they treat these horses. And my understanding of the science is that hair testing could exonerate me. And I've been involved in at least one case in my role as ombudsman where I did request or asked the trainer to request hair testing, and it helped to establish a timeline for when the drug might have gotten into the horse. So it worked here. And so that's the first point. The second point is what people are talking about is concern about buying horses at sales now that may have prohibited substances in them. I mean, you can run a drug test, which might or might not show, but, you know, what are we going to do about now the, you know, the horses coming out of these sales, particularly two-year-olds, and the potential to cause a positive test? And so people are saying, why aren't the sales companies regulated? Why isn't the breeding industry regulated? And the answer to that question is that a number of us, as we knew that the Congress was going to move forward with HISA, had insisted that the breeding industry and breeding practices be part of HISA, but the sales companies and certain interests that were responsible for HISA and HIWU fought vociferously against it, and we couldn't get it into the bill. Therefore, the answer is that there's a limited ability of HISA to regulate the breeding industry. The response I got back was that, well, there's a provision in the statute that, you know, under the FTC prohibits unfair business practices. So we could certainly prosecute if we determined that there was an unfair or improper business practice. No, that's not going to do it. And so absent an amendment to the statute, because the statute only confers jurisdiction on two-year-olds who have had a time to work out, you're not going to get jurisdiction over them. So you need to get the sales companies to cooperate and voluntarily do it. And I suspect that HISA is in conversations with the sales companies because this is now a big area of concern. And hopefully there'll be some protocols that will be implemented to help make this work.
Appreciate it. Alan, while we're also together, and when I reached out to you yesterday, you were knee-deep in Maryland work. Anything you want to update people on since we spoke last at the end of the year?
Well, there are numerous agreements being negotiated, and the Maryland legislature is in session until April the 8th, and the legislature has to pass enabling legislation to allow this whole project to go forward. They're waiting for the signed agreements to move the legislation. So if you want a timeline, it's the next 45 days for this all to come together. But there are a lot of moving parts. There's a tremendous amount of work being done. I am absolutely confident that the agreements will be reached and that legislation will be introduced, hopefully within the next 2 weeks. And that it will then move through the legislative process.
Keep us apprised.
Yeah, can't say more. It wouldn't matter anyway. Gotcha. At this point, it's just a tremendous amount of manpower and work being done in a number of different directions. And you know, the timeline is if we're able to, you know, get this enacted, is to hopefully have the 2027 Preakness at the new Pimlico. So we'll see. I think we'll have a better sense of it in the next few months. That's as to at least the timeline.
Alan Forman, everybody, ombudsman, and so much more. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
You got it. Alan Forman, everybody. So, you know, you can appreciate what goes into this. I think we'll stay here, and because I got to get to Brian. Brian Cohen's going to join us from Arendelle, and looking forward to this. Have not had the pleasure, and of course, Brian and his dad Alan, of course, they as prominent as any outfit in Florida, and big win on Saturday in the Razorback. Brian Cohen, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And congratulations. I mean, this is a horse that, you know, it has been kind of operating, you know, steadily, and this feels like one of those nice next steps that you look forward to.
Yeah, he's a small, unassuming horse that's, you know, just got a huge heart, and, you know, he's just done great for us. He's Brethren's first millionaire, and... He's always trying, and you know, we thought he'd have a big 3-year-old year, but he, you know, just minor issues, and we've taken our time with him, and but he's just he's a 5-year-old now, and hopefully has, you know, has a big year for us.
It's a breakthrough on the graded stake front. I mean, and it's amazing, actually, and it speaks to the Florida program that you guys are heavily invested in. Going into the race, he had earned $700,000. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's the early 2-year-old program in Florida is pretty lucrative, and he won the two big races here, and after he won the second big one of the 2-year-old, we thought about shipping him to California for the Breeders' Cup, but like I said, he's a small horse and he's really light. We thought shipping him across after, you know, running back-to-back-to-back races would maybe hurt him, and we just gave him a little time on the farm to you know, just focus on his 3-year-old year, and he had a foot problem that just took forever to get over, and then he came back, and he missed the big prep races, but he's run some big races, and you know, we thought, you know, maybe when he came back, he won big, that we could point towards the Pegasus, because, you know, he's the type of horse that, you know, he's got speed, and he can carry it over a quirky track like Gulfstream or Oaklawn, and we thought that he could maybe get there, and, you know, we ran him in the Harlan's Holiday, and he just acted up in the gate, and it just threw everything off, and he didn't get an invite there, so that was not meant to be, but he ran a big race in the Sunshine Million Classic, and we were looking at maybe the Gulfstream Park Mile coming up, or Tampa, which he's 1-for-1 at, you know, which seems like another quirky track, and when I nominated him for the Razorback just in case, you know, with the Saudi races and Dubai and the Pegasus horses, I thought maybe it could come up light, and it looked like it did, so we shipped him out there, and it worked out.
It worked out beautifully, and of course, you know, you got the option later to go back, perhaps, when you got the, you know, the Oaklawn handicap, and of course, running for the money that they're offering at Oaklawn, that's a good condition book to have to thumb through.
Yeah, certainly. You know, that's where I think we'd. You know, we'll see over the next, it's April 20th, so some time there. And I just don't know what his distance limitation is. You know, I think that configuration of a mile and 16th really suits him, but I think he can get a mile and an eighth. And, you know, we just haven't tried it yet. And, you know, we'll see what the race is coming up like. But I think that seems like a logical spot to try. But I think, you know, a really good miler, but, you know, the way he's built and how much speed he has, you know, a Charlestown Classic type, you know, those are the type of races that I feel like, but this next race will kind of gauge where, you know, where the rest of the, the season, you know, takes us.
Now, he's an 8-time winner now. We're talking about Octane. He's a brethren. And, you know, in terms of the operation, let's talk about, you and your dad and how you guys approach it. You've had lots of success over the years. And you give everybody some, you know, it's kind of a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, Dad and I, we work together closely, and you know, we started just when we brought Brethren over, we primarily breed to race, but we've transitioned now to being more commercial, and we have a lot of race horses, but now we're breeding more towards selling and you know, running a handful, and we still have, you know, 15, 20 to run, but Dad and I, we work together, and Juan Alvarado is, you know, he breaks our babies on the farm, and he handles everything on the farm, and, you know, he does a tremendous job with that, and my wife and I, we work down at Gulfstream together, Banny Olson, who's a jockey, we work together now at Gulfstream. And Dad and I, we love the races, but you know, and we keep supporting Florida, and Brethren has just been great for us. I think he's a little underrated. He's got, you know, we were hoping that for Brethren he'd have Octane maybe in the Pegasus, and Clapton, who was our Pegasus hope, who we sold to RRR Racing, who's pointing him to the Dubai World Cup. That
right.
would be a good thing for Brethren to have, you know, Clapton from the Breeders' Cup Classic to Dubai, and Octane and the Pegasus, which was, you know, we had 20 colts that crop, and those two were, you know, part of that crop, and you know, we had a couple other really nice colts that you know, from Brethren that crop, and he's been great for us, and the program's been good for us, and you know, and We generally don't get out of Florida, but you know, we've been to Oakland a couple times and New York a few times, but hopefully Octane brings us around a little bit more.
And how many mares overall, outside mares, does he cover? He stands at the farm, of course, in Ocala.
Not too many. You know, for the most part, I feel like Florida breeding is. Everyone wants the freshman sire, and you know, Brethren. I don't know why, but he doesn't get too many outside mares. But I feel like by when it's too late, then people will realize how good he really was, because you know, he's been so good for us, and you know, with longevity of runners, and you know, turf, dirt, long, short, he's really gotten everything for us, and we can't ask for more.
Well, and of course, you know, he was named Brethren because of Super Saver, and out of Supercharger, the great AP Indy mare by Distorted Humor, and you know, he number two, right? Number two in Florida, second leading stallion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kozan has been number one, and you know, Kozan's been good, but Kozan hasn't had a $1 million horse now. so Brethren's got him there. But, and hopefully too, after the next, you know, month with Clapton. But, you know, but yeah, he's been great for us.
Talk a little bit about what really has been, and we'll be down at Ocala, and we'll do plenty of this at OBS for, you know, the sale. We'll be there for all 3 days, the 12th, 13th, 14th. But you know, there had been a little bit of a lag, and you know, now it feels like the pendulum has swung, you know, back up. And of course, Ocala, you know, Brian, I mean, the value of the farms, and Ocala has never been a hotter property. You fold in the World Equestrian Center, and I mean, it feels like Ocala is, you know, it's kind of a place to be.
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, I was up there for a good 10 years, and now I've been down south, and And it's amazing how every time I'm up there now, you know, just the traffic on the small roads, it's, you know, noticeably, you know, much more difficult to get around up there. And, you know, Florida has just been, the population has just been going more and more north, and it's going to be, it's just going to keep growing. And you know, it is a great spot, and I like to go up there. And this year will be, you know, our first kind of real go at the two-year-old sales. So we're looking for, we have 4 in March and we have 7 in April. So, you know, we had 17 two-year-old winners last year, and you know, we just think that we can provide, Florida with something different, you know, as far as, what we focus on and getting horses ready as two-year-olds. So we're excited, and, you know, I'll be up there in a couple of weeks to support the sale. We're looking forward to that.
Very nice. You handling them yourself, or do you have a sales arm?
Yeah. No, we are selling under Arendelle, and we have 2 brethrens, and we have a Neolithic and a Bajero. So. But we do everything ourselves. So,
you know, very nice.
Come by and check them out.
There you go. A little plug. I'm so happy to give you a plug. Talk about the family's involvement. You know, and of course your dad. You know, notable sportsman professionally. When it comes to what? How many business interests in professional sports?
He's right now he just loves the horses, and he and I, we work together, and you know, it's, we have a great relationship, and we're both just big fans of horses right now, and we just regardless of the type of race it is, you know, whether it's a bottom end maiden claimer or octane in a grid stake, we just get just as excited to watch the races, and, you know, and talk about them afterwards and figure out where we're going to go next, and just make plans for the future as far as breeding and whatever else. But we have a great relationship, and I have a couple of brothers that aren't as into horse racing as we are, but they like to get involved also.
Your dad, when I talk about the sports side, thinking about the Panthers, but what drew him to the horses? How early? Because I remember years ago, wait a while, right? That was the first one that I think when I first noticed the name. And did he grow up in Florida or settled?
Yeah, he grew up in New York, but he came down here very young, and you know, he bought 2 horses, and one of them happened to be Wait a While, and
wow,
that kind of drew him in, and then he the farm came next, and then we just started going from there. But it was a good start in horse racing with Wait a While.
To say the least. From there, you've been a long standing presence. You know, and it's interesting because I know that from a business, you know, from a early business side, the same business as Bob Edwards, right? As E5, generic drugs, mm-hmm. right? The same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which is kind of interesting. It's been, generic drug manufacturing has been very good to racing. Between your dad, between you guys and Bob Edwards, it's kind of cool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Talking to Brian Cohen, Arendelle, and what the Arendelle name? What's the origin?
Yeah, you know, I think when Dad started Arendelle, he looked in an almanac and just tried to find something that only meant Arendelle. And he, you know, picked something with an A and named Arendelle. And then, you know, 6 years later, I think the movie Frozen came out for Disney, where they taking place in Arendelle.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Went from the Elizabethan to that, and then they ruined it for us.
That is funny.
So that's where that came from. It was just trying to be unique and ended up being the opposite.
I love it. That's great. Wow, we get a heavy dose because we've got our 4-year-old granddaughter and the Elsa and Anna stuff is just nonstop, right?
I have a 2-year-old and a 6-month-old, and I understand it.
I'd love it. Well, Brian, I was looking forward to this. I wanted to be sure to acknowledge what a nice win this was for Octane, and there's plenty to come. He's a gelding, so this is a horse that people can follow. Breakthrough graded stake win and a millionaire, and adds a little bit of luster to Brethren's resume. So well done, and thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it.
Not at all. Brian Cohen, everybody, Arendelle, and here's the win by Octane. Julian Leperu, nice for Julian. Knocked me out of everything. Let's be honest. This was not, as I said yesterday, it was a tricky horse. He was okay in there, but more than okay, actually. And nobody was getting by. Magic Tap, Notary were, in close attendance, and that was that. Going back, if you listen to Friday, I knew it, as the day was going, as the show was going on Friday, and as one after another of us were picking Escapologist, when that happens, you just can guarantee that you're not getting anything. There were too many people in that direction. One here, one there, somebody mentions, okay, that's all right. But the fact that all of us wanted Escapologist, and the funny part is, of course, that Julian Leperu had been his regular rider. He rides a lot for McPeak, but here was Brian, who, Hernandez gets tons of work from Ken. And maybe there was, maybe that was the first time actually that they'd used Julian Leperu. And why, as Brian explained, one of the reasons I reached for Brian, because I knew that he's actually, handling and managing the string in Florida. And Juan Alvarado's up on the farm and is supervising from there. The horses that cycle back and forth. So I wanted to give Brian a chance to be acknowledged for the accomplishment. Couple of minutes, I'm going to reach for Whit Beckman as well. And before we do that, let me slip in a couple of results that we have not, that we didn't get to yesterday. All right. The PPs, there we go. Gulfstream will save. I didn't see. I think I should have asked them if there was one. I think only one horse I saw that they had a. It's not Saturday. It's not on the Saturday card. They had one. I think they got a maiden that is running. We talked with John yesterday. Up, oh, I got to find. We got to get the answer and see who won. How the jocks did against the kids. Right, the Holy Angels jockey game, the two Tampa stakes that we talked about with Barry and in the Lightning City, Play the Music, Mark Cassie, and Glassman Racing. This the Motown Philly that we had discussed actually went favorite, went off at 5-2, and was a pretty clear. If you saw that, was a pretty clear winner. And Cassie, the Cassie barn, clicking along quietly, but well. And then you did have a little bit more of a price in the
boys race in the Turf Dash. 6-1. Doug Nunn. Congratulations to Doug Nunn. This is great. Another Jersey bred. More, it was a big weekend for, I said this yesterday, right? A big weekend for Jersey breds between Bookham Dano's good effort and this win by the Frost Giant 8-year-old gelding Smithwick Spice. Very nice. Centeno gets this one. This is a 10-time winner, this Jersey bred. Very nice. And this was a nice turn back, actually. Turnbacks don't seem to be as potent for whatever reason. Andy and I talk about this. Turnbacks on turf are not as potent as the turn as a turnback on dirt. I mean, I think we, with the proliferation of turf sprints, you know, there was that learning curve. And one thing, you know, we watched for a while, and then we kind of realized that it just doesn't have the same power. But in this particular case, Smithwick Spice was 3-for-5 already coming in at 5.5 or 5. So, I mean, he's an accomplished turf sprinter. Last turf sprint win for him had come in June of last year at Delaware, actually, and he was taken down out of that spot. But still, I mean, 3-for-5 in his career. And he also is a horse that likes Tampa. He came over from Gulfstream and ran very well in a starter allowance last time with Saez. But Centeno has ridden him pretty regularly. And his last straight win also came at Delaware, going 1 1/16. So a nice, versatile horse out of a good and tough mare. Pretty cool. New Spice stable. Homebred that's made 40 starts now. How much fun is this to have an 8-year-old win an open stake like this? He does compete back at Monmouth in, you know, the stakes, the Irish War Cry and the Charlie Hess. So this is nice. This is an open company stake win. So congratulations to New Spice stable. And those of you that, I think I did, Barry, where's my Tampa notes? I don't know if Barry, and Barry, I know, got one of these at least, if not both. He was against one of the favorites. He was against How About Them Apples, but How About Them Apples did not go favored. The money went to play the music. Then at Fairgrounds, slip this in too. We mentioned yesterday, which was so much fun. I got a lot. People really enjoyed hearing from Todd Fincher yesterday. Thanks to Todd for that extended visit. Accommodate Eva, as we've noted, and actually vied. There were three horses within 30 cents of each other in this broodmare lipstick junkie stake, the $100,000 Louisiana broodmare stake. Accommodate Eva with Corey Lannery and Dallas Stewart, of course. This for Valine. And then when it came to the boys' race, Tom Holyfield's homebred by Always Dreaming, Brittany's Dream, an exciting winner. Paid $13.40 with Guerrero. That for Shane Wilson, who just, Shane Wilson killing it. And not just with Britlin horses, obviously. And because we had the visit with Chris Katulak, I got to mention the winner at Fawner, right? Marissa Black sent out the 5-year-old Hightail gelding, Hacker. Hacker, a 5-to-1 winner of the Grassmix Stake. And got a nice fig, got a 77 buyer, I saw. Yeah, nice job with J.A. Medina. One, two, three was fourth choice. Hacker. It's a nice horse. It's fifth win. And it's
been popular at the claim box too. Got Clark claim actually just he's moved around a little bit, but owner Gerald Wollison. This was Zanarchy bred, bred by Circle Bar H. So that was your grass mix steak at second weekend of action. And finally, and then we'll reach for Wit. Javier Castellano on Run Classic for Tom Durant. And this is a Run Happy. It's been around, Run Classic. Nice win. Brett Calhoun, of course, had trained this for the most part and has been at Palmetto's. This was a six-year-old debut out of one of my favorite mares from the Ropara pledge pin. Is that a pledge pin on your uniform? What kind of a man, what kind of a fraternity would pledge? Delta, sir. the best, the absolute greatest. All right, let's get Whit Beckman in here. Otherwise, I will give you the entire script of Animal House. too funny. All right, here we go. Yep, this worked out perfect. Whit needed a couple extra minutes, and it came together fine. What else? We got Laurel to do, and... we've got a couple more. Cleanups. For, there he is. Whit Beckman, good morning.
Hey.
All right. You're the man of the hour.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I'm laughing because the other day, last week, we were talking about, where horses are, headed out of certain assignments and certain, performances. And I got a secretive, text saying, you can't say anything, but I think Drip is going to go to Tampa. And well, then sure enough, word has now leaked out. So I said, all right, I was good about it, Whit, so I can keep a secret.
Yeah, I'm impressed. I know who can keep secrets, though.
That's pretty good. We'll let everybody connect the dots. It's got to be so much fun. You wake up in the morning, you probably get up at 3:30 every morning and can't wait to get to the barn right now.
Well, when I'm in Louisville, though, we don't start training until 11, so when I wake up that early, I got a lot of... time to kill in between that, so still it's exciting, and yeah, it keeps me jumping out of bed with some enthusiasm for sure.
Well, let's start with Drip, and the performance obviously got people excited, and it is the time of year where your hand is somewhat forced. We're seeing something similar with Victory Avenue running in the Fountain for Gustavo Delgado and the essentially the Mage team. Talk about this good magic colt and the thoughts going in and then what's forcing your hand to give him a try at the gold ring.
He's obviously talented. We saw that in his race. He's been very consistent training, leading up to that. We were hopeful that he was going to kind of put a impressive show on debut, and he did just that. Like I said, with three-year-olds this time of year, the allowance races just don't seem to come up too often. And when they do, they're not going short fields, whatever the case is. So, looking at the, next spot for him, that is, probably not going to be something we can find as an allowance race. We're going to try at Fairgrounds. If it goes, there's a few things playing into it. But Tampa, kind of being timing-wise and not looking like it's going to be the toughest of the, kind of middle preps leading, into the Derby, we just figured it would be a logical place to take him. It is back a little quick, 3 weeks. We're going to kind of look at these noms and see how much, he gives up in experience and whatnot. But like I said, with this time of year, you kind of got to put a lot of that stuff to the side and you know, take your shot. But when you have a horse like him, it makes it a little easier to make those decisions.
Talk about, you know, the backstory, and yeah, this is kind of a fun encouragement scenario for a lot of people. A $90,000 yearling in July at Phasig, and you know, how quickly you know, did it become apparent as he was getting developed? How quickly, you know, was it clear that there was some talent and it's something to be excited about?
Yeah, I mean, Legion Bloodstock, they purchased him, you know, for a great price. He spent his, you know, early days with Travis Durdown, South Carolina, and Travis had this horse kind of nailed from the beginning. He said he's a really nice colt, you know, if I don't, you know, he was amongst the tops of his, you know, crop last year. So he was a little later to get, you know, kind of get going. So he didn't really come to me until, I say, late October. But once he did, I mean, he hasn't missed a beat since. He's just continued to get, I think, you know, bigger, stronger, and just develop mentally, physically, just doing all the things that a horse that, you know, warrants a chance in these type races needs to do. It's funny, the partners that are in on this particular horse, you know, it's Alan and Carrie Ribble, who are also majority owners of Honor Marie, who was also a Legion Bloodstock purchase, you know, for $40,000 as a yearling. So, you know, finding these type gems in there and having a few good people in there and kind of seeing if anybody else wants in, if anybody wants to sell, it's just a great way for, you know, everybody to enjoy the part of the game they want to enjoy.
Well, we're going to talk about Anna Marie, obviously, in a minute as well. Drip is a good magic out of the Super Saver mare, Sky Saver, Ramp Spring, bred Drip. And, you know, at first asking, I had a kind of a funny exchange on Twitter with Jareth Loveberry. I said, you know, now that he got a taste of Derby, he's going to be itching to get back.
Yeah, he ran, you know, two fills last year, and, you know, he started breezing this horse for me at Fairgrounds, you know, kind of early on when we first arrived, and, you know, he'd come back smiling on this horse every single time. I don't think he ever had anything other than just, you know, positive feedback, and just, you know, he's the kind of horse everybody, I think, wants to sit on, judging by Jared's body language, and, yeah, enthusiasm after the works.
You gave... Was that Grenning? Was that Dave's? I think Dave Grenning's piece.
Yeah, Dave. I talked to him today.
Talk about your experience with Chad and with cloud computing, because you invoked the cloud computing approach.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of similar timing wise. You know, they're both obviously very talented 3-year olds. They were just getting started very late. I think cloud computing model broke his maiden in a few weeks, maybe a week or two earlier, early February, you know, and then kind of went back pretty quick to the Gotham, the Wood, you know, and he obviously showed up well in those, but it was probably experience wise, not, you know, right move going to the Derby, and Chad made a, you know, brilliant move, put him in the Preakness, and we saw, you know, what we saw there. So with this horse, you know, nothing's off the table. We're going to kind of give him the shot here at the next level, and say the good horses, the ones that deserve to be there, will take you there. And the ones that you're kind of like, it's better, you know, if you can make that decision. It's a tough decision to skip that race, you know. That's everybody's bucket list race. So, you know, we'll just kind of let him, you know, see how far he wants to take us.
Pretty exciting. A quick note about the mare, Sky Saver. She actually has the nice stakes placed filly Procrastination, the Not This Time. And then, unfortunately, after Drip, she was barren in 22, and she lost her foal last year. So waiting to see she drops for 24. And it's interesting. I'm going to bring this horse up, the breeding up with Sid tomorrow. It's kind of an interesting family. There's a little bit of everything in here. All right. Well, we're certainly excited, you know, for you, for Jareth, and for the Legion team. Let's talk about Anna Marie and, you know, what was undoubtedly a, you know, I don't want to call it a, disappointment's not fair. I mean, you hope for, you know, a good seasonal debut, and you know, finishes fifth in there, it's a jumping off point.
Correct. Yeah, I wasn't discouraged by the start at all. I mean, there's, you know, a few things leading up to it that could have gone a little better, but, you know, with horse racing or training, you just kind of got to, you know, adjust and take everything in stride, you know, and we thought he was still, you know, ready for the start. You know, the day was real nasty, had a lot of rain leading up to it. It was very windy, blustery, just a real not, you know, ideal day for horses. But pace and just positioning, just kind of the inter-race dynamics didn't really work out for him to kind of make that, you know, move and make it a little closer. But he still did run a very fast final quarter. You know, he galloped out very well. He did all of the things that to build on, you know, you're setting a pretty solid foundation, you know, kind of moving into the three-year-old year. So most importantly, he came out of the race so good. After the jockey club, he was, you know, tired, you know, took him a couple days to recover, kind of get back, you know, in his feet tubs, on his feet, really, you know, feeling it. But, I mean, the next day I came in, he cleaned up his feet. He was bouncing around the shed row like, yeah, ready for more. So for me, that's the most encouraging thing. And obviously, we'll take a couple points and, you know, like I said, if he's meant to be there, he'll get there.
What has gone on since? You know, you got one. Did you work yet or no?
No. I'm actually, I'm in Louisville right now. I'm going to drive down tomorrow and just kind of play the, you know, New Orleans has, it seemed like every weekend I've gone down there since winter started, it's rained. So we're just going to kind of play it by ear with the weather, but I'm pointing him and Drip towards the work, hopefully. Anywhere from Thursday to Sunday or Monday, just depending on our track conditions and weather and any other anything else we, you know, see when we get down there.
Very good. And Louisiana Derby on tab, and you're not thinking about any other option.
Not with him. I think, you know, hopefully we get a fast track and just the added distance. I think with this horse particularly is going to make it. You know, he'll improve with the added distance. I think every time, you know, we've been, you know, the mile of 16th, he was pretty sharp at that. The mile of 8 just kind of got a bad trip, but I'm, you know, excited to get him running a little bit further. And plus just being in Louisiana already, running out of the stall, just a lot of things I don't feel the need to change.
Well, we're at the juncture where we got to find out what else is going on. Those are the two big horses, obviously. And, you just got the season kind of unfolding and, Give us a look ahead. I see that coming up on Sunday, she's a baddie looking to graduate.
Yeah, she is a World of Trouble filly, kind of the same thing, but as a two-year-old or a yearling started by Legion. And she had a little trouble, you know, kind of getting to the races early. You know, we had some rain there and just things kind of, you know, delayed her start till this point now, but she's been training forwardly. I mean, you know, training on the dirt, we're going to run her 5.5 on grass. She's by World of Trouble. She's got seemingly a pretty strong turf pedigree and, you know, turf look about her. And said first time, it's not easy, but if she does it, we'll be, you know, super proud of her.
Well, this is a filly that was bred by Westbrook Stables and a $67,000 yearling, and Evan Cianello, part of the hard-charging Legion team. And I think the big question everybody will want to know Sunday is Anna going to be there, and is she going to be wearing her new wardrobe?
I don't know. I don't know where they're going to be. I can't imagine they're coming down for Batty, but maybe.
Did you see Anna's get up from the other day?
No, we're from where?
From Saudi Arabia.
No, but I did spend enough time in Saudi Arabia to assume they have some pretty, probably some pretty amazing fashion going on over there.
Well, she may be in a tent somewhere by now. Actually, you better check with Evan. Actually,
and see if she made it back.
Yeah, exactly.
Part of Cemetery.
Exactly. When you see the picture, you'll know. It'll all make sense.
Gotcha.
What else is going on the shed row? Is there anybody else that this is a first timer? Any other
couple? You know. Up in trackside in Louisville, you know, we're kind of getting off to a slow turf way. It's been tough up there. So obviously it's very good racing anymore with the purses. So sure. Just trying to kind of, you know, tick away at that. I think what I got up there coming up, just, yeah, a few maidens, nothing real, nothing really to keep on the radar, but hopefully as they kind of, you know, get their feet about them, we can find the right spots for them. But yeah, all in all, it's just kind of business as usual, steady, and just trying to get everybody pointed in the right direction and mostly gearing up for spring and summer. You know, I tend to take it a little easy in the winter, and every year we kind of gotten off to slow starts, and you know, this year being no different. So, but honestly, we're just, trying to get through to the bigger purses, the better weather, and yeah.
Nice. How about a quick Harlan Estate update out of the fairgrounds try?
Yeah, the fairgrounds. You know, the turf came up real soft that day. It rained the whole thing. I've, you know, always kind of known this horse was his best on firm, good ground, and he just didn't get it that day. Positioning-wise, you know, being outside, it seemed like the couple other turf races, everybody run up the rail, so... Just a few things. I think the horse is doing very well. He looks great, training well. I expect a big year for him. And it was kind of the same thing last year. He took a couple races to get himself off the bench and, you know, really into the mix of things. But I'm confident that, you know, as the summer rolls around, we're going to be in some, you know, pretty good spots with him.
Well, yeah, you got some big spots, obviously, coming up. The excitement around the barn. Anna Marie and Drip, and could be a very big season. And of course, you know, the most important meet for the barn is always Kentucky Downs. Everything points to Kentucky Downs.
Yeah, hopefully we got some. I know I may have got a few. Sabalenka's supposed to come back in here soon. She's been on the farm with a little R&R and Harlem Estate. And then, yeah, hopefully we can pick up a few other KY Downs horses.
There it is. Whit Beckman, well done. And, keep him moving forward, and we're looking forward. I'll be down to Louisiana Derby Week, looking forward to it. All right?
All right, well, we'll see you then.
I appreciate it. Whit Beckman, everybody, and the Legion Racing, the Hard Chargers, as we call them, and pretty exciting with Drip and the nice partner group that's involved as well with Anna Marie. And, you know, as just like Whit said, they got some more points, at, you know, the points that had already... been nabbed at the Kentucky Jockey Club win. So, you know, another, I mean, it'd be great to win the Louisiana Derby, I suppose, but probably be, you know, just as satisfied with another good effort and points to get them into Derby. And they can ship back to the Ville and get ready. He's... Nobody should have been, you know, discouraged out of that Risen Star effort. So, Anna Marie, yeah, all five at the top. You know, Catching Freedom we talked about yesterday with Brad, and Track Phantom, of course. Sierra Leone is going to be elsewhere. That probably will suit the horses that were chasing him home. Yeah, I think all of those, right, are, I haven't heard anything from Mott, actually, about, has anybody seen the Resilience follow-up? We've got to find out about Resilience, who we liked going into the, ran okay, just flattened out. We're going to flatten out here for the first half, which has been a full bore. Not boring, I hope, but full bore set of conversations with Brian Cohen from Arundel and with Beckman just now, and we started the morning with Alan Foreman. Dr. All Day next, Andy Serling coming, and I'm still pending on that 11:30 that I'm hoping for. We'll see about it, all right? At the Races, 90 plus in the books, 90 to come. Back after this.
It is At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
PA Bred, I think we've built a brand at this point.
The state of Pennsylvania has the best breeders program in the entire United States.
Angel of Empire wins the Arkansas Derby and wins it clear.
Carabelle!
Iowa in the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint.
Pennsylvania and the PHBA have the best state bred program in the country, bar none.
The best Breeders' Awards and Stallion Awards in the country.
If you're racing two-year-olds in California and Kentucky, please consider Bleeder Shield. The leading all-natural paste used to greatly reduce or eliminate EIPH. The list of trainers who trust Bleeder Shield is endless.